Hello, I'm Barry Daniel, and this is the podcast of the Middle Way Society. Our aim is to encourage a universal approach to living a more integrated, ethical life, avoiding dogma or any absolute appeal to authority. Our guest today is Jeremy Sherman. Jeremy is a decision theorist researching and writing about choice from the origin of life to everyday living. He teaches college courses across the social sciences and blogs for Psychology Today. He's here to talk to us about his latest book, Neither Ghost Nor Machine, in which he distills for a general audience the theory developed by renowned neuroscientist Terence Deacon that extends the breakthrough constraint-based insight that inspired evolutionary information and self-organization theory. He argues that emergent dynamics theory provides a testable hypothesis for how mattering arose from matter, function from physics, and means-to-ends behavior from cause and effect dynamics. In effect, what this offers is a physics of purpose and can make science safe for value. We'll also talk about how all this might relate to the Middle Way. Okay, so hello, Jeremy. Welcome to the Middle Way Society podcast.
Nice to be here. Pleasure to be here.
Perhaps you could begin, Jeremy, by telling us a bit about your background and how you became interested in this field of work.
Wonderful question and pertinent for the Middle Way Society. About 25 years ago, going back a little bit further, I had lived on the world's largest hippie commune, a place called The Farm, in Summertown, Tennessee. It was 1,400 people, and we lived by fundamental moral principles. And I ended up leaving it and working for years, including years in England, working for the Body Shop International as head of public affairs, and then got a master's in public policy at Berkeley. I had been working as an activist most of my life, and then hit a wonderful midlife crisis. It didn't feel wonderful at the time at all. It felt miserable. I cried daily. But it was a very deep cosmic wedgie. It really pulled me up short. Mm-hmm. And often when people have a midlife crisis like that, they go from one absolute to its opposite.
Yeah.
An approach that I call, I once was lost, but now I'm blind. And I wasn't going that way. I had gone through, I had changed my core principles often enough that I got interested instead during this midlife crisis in how we choose among options. One of the core insights I had at the time was we didn't fall from grace, we rose from slime. That is that we started out, that living beings are, they're struggling to figure out what to do. They're trying to find the right response to each circumstances, and they can get it wrong.
Yeah.
So one of my core insights at that time was very much a middle way one. Not the middle way one where there's a set point that you just stay halfway between this and that.
Oh, no.
It occurred to me at the time that that wouldn't work, for example, with Hitler. If the Jews had gone to Hitler and said, look, you want to kill 6 million of us, we want you to kill zero, how about 3 million?
Yeah,
the middle way, that way will not work.
No, that's just the middle way of convention, yes, of course.
That's right. It's a kind of averaging. That's not what I was looking for. I got very interested in life's tough judgment calls. Fundamental to this was an interest in the Serenity Prayer. And all this time I was focused on evolutionary psychology. And then I meet Terence Deacon, who was a researcher who seemed to get this and was unlike other researchers in that he wasn't just describing or declaring it. He was working out something fundamental to your work, the relationship between facts and values.
Okay.
The assumption being we living beings are all at risk in ways that inanimate things are not. That is, we have skin in the game, we're trying to get it right.
Yeah.
And that means that we have inherent values. If we're at risk, that means that we're actually striving to survive. And Terence, who is a neuroscientist who had spent 20 years working on the origins of human language, and had written an important book that I had read by the time I met him, read and cried while reading, because it was overwhelming. It was over my head. But anyway, I met this guy at a conference, and we started working together. He had just taken on a project that I've been part of for 22 years now, trying to explain the emergence of values, or valuing, striving selves, organisms, trying to get it right because they're at risk, from nothing but physics and chemistry. So how do you bridge the gap from physics and chemistry to life and mind? How do you bridge that gap, not descriptively, but with a thorough explanation of how you go from matter to mattering?
Well, I think the book is a fantastic attempt to answer that question. So why the title?
Oh, it's we tried out lots of titles, but we think we nailed it with this one. If you're asking where do values come from, there are two easy responses. There's actually the responses that have been popular over the years fall into a variety of categories. But two of the core ones are, well, there are no values, actually. So my book is called Neither Ghost Nor Machine. The machine part is there's no values. All there is facts. There's cause and effect, relationships between things. Nothing really matters. I had been a very big fan of Richard Dawkins before I met Terry. I had the full effect that the New York Times reviewers described as it makes every reader feel like a genius. And one of the things about it was this kind of this assumption that it's all mechanism all the way down. And then in his approach, there's this he allows for a kind of poetry in saying that it's as though the genes are selfish. Of course, the genes are just molecules, but it's as though they're selfish. Mm-hmm. So like many researchers, he's willing to equivocate. He says it's nothing but cause and effect. But it's as if there's this means to ends kind of behavior, this striving that we see the genes do. So that's the machine side of it. The ghost side of it is any of the models that say, well, there's some supernatural thing that is poured into chemistry or pumped into chemistry, perhaps by God, that makes the chemistry come alive. So our core point is this: living things value. And yet there's nothing that our bodies ever do that ever defy the laws of physics and chemistry. So we've got something different from nothing but chemistry. Mm-hmm. Nothing was added, so there's no ghost pumped into it, and it's still different. It's not just a machine. So what the heck explains it? That is the question we feel we have to corner ourselves with if we're going to get anywhere on understanding the relationship between facts and values.
Fascinating. So you bore down on the term cells. Why did you find it helpful to describe all living things as cells?
It's a good question. Terry and I, Terry Deacon, the developer, the originator of these ideas, and I take walks, dog walks. He has a dog, a Bernese Mountain Dog. We find it a good opportunity. He's a busy man, but we take them almost... These days it's been daily, and a lot of it is spent trying to figure out what words to use so as to not bring in either the ghost or the machine implications, the baggage that tends to accompany words. As recently as 3 months ago, I was saying that organisms try, and then we decided, no, we should actually go with strive. It's a little bit cleaner.
Yeah.
Is it perfectly clean? No. So the question of whether I call all living things beings, agents, organisms, living things, there's a variety of names for them. We chose self in that they are all engaged in self-directed behavior, self-directed work, to be specific. That is, all living beings, they exhibit work by the self for the self's benefit, given its circumstances. So you've got three things that are fundamental to selves that aren't evident in inanimate objects. That is, we do work, which is striving.
Yeah.
for our benefit, which is functional. When you think about the term functional, it means useful for, good for, all of that, all of the stuff that pertains to values.
Yeah.
Given their circumstances, which means that they are fitted to their circumstances. Those are three terms. We've got function. We've got striving, function, and fittedness. You cannot do anything in the life and social sciences without them. They are inescapable terms in the life and social sciences, and then they are inadmissible terms in physics and chemistry. A physicist cannot say the moon pulls on the tides, because it is striving to achieve something for its own benefit, given its circumstances. You cannot, if a physics professor said that, we'd think him a lunatic. But you cannot do without them in the life and social sciences. So there's this enormous rift down the middle of all academic research. And if you ask for an explanation for why it is inadmissible in the physical sciences and absolutely inescapable in the life and social sciences, we have no answer to date.
Okay, well, let's start walking through the thesis, Jeremy. So what seems... first of all, fundamental in understanding your theory is how the second law of thermodynamics plays out. You say arguably the thing that is most regular in the universe is its tendency towards irregularity.
Yes. So one of the reasons we like the term striving for what all living beings do, what I'm calling for shorthand selves, but this makes for a kind of counterintuitive move in that I'm saying a bacterium is a self. But one of the things that's nice about the term striving is it implies going against the flow.
Yeah.
So what is the flow that life has to go against? It's remarkable how much this is overlooked in physics, in biology. It has to regenerate in the face of degeneration. So the second law of thermodynamics is basically everything degenerates. It's employed in explaining what goes on in energy, but the same is true of, you could say, material composition, that is, things fall apart. But in energy, what we know is that energy is never lost in the universe, and yet it dissipates, it dilutes, and therefore becomes unusable for work. So in effect, everything peters out. Yeah. So the core thing that life has to strive against is this tendency to fall apart, to peter out and fall apart. Okay. I mean, if you look at a core wonder in the universe is this. We are very fragile things. Cells are very fragile things.
Yeah.
You can tell that they're very fragile because when they die, they degenerate very quickly. Okay. While they're alive, the something different about them from nothing but chemistry is that they regenerate, or else we wouldn't still be here 3.8 billion years after our origins. So that's the mystery we have to explain.
Yeah. And then you make the further point that the second law isn't a force. It's a consequence of the absence of constraint. So in order to find regularity or patterns in the universe, we need some form of constraint. Am I right in saying that?
Yes, yes. So the punchline or core message in our approach, remember the question is, there's something different from nothing but chemistry. So what could it be? Because it's not something added to chemistry. We've ruled that out. No ghosts. And it's not the same as chemistry. What it is that, yes, we are nothing but chemistry, but not just any chemistry. While we are alive, we are preventing all sorts of chemical possibilities. We are preventing ourselves from dying.
Yeah.
That's obvious. But the core then becomes constraint. What do we mean by constraint? When we think of constraints, we mostly think of what I'm calling in the book imposed constraints. A riverbank would be an example. Water would fall every which way if it weren't constrained by the riverbank, which is a solid external, you could say, or extrinsic force that limits. In engineering, a lot of what's going on in all our technology is constraint wrangling, that is designing preventions. That's what insulation is on wires. That's what cylinders are on engine. If you had a gas explosion with no cylinder, it would generate in every which direction. But if you impose the constraint of a cylinder, it makes all of the pressure go in one direction. So those are imposed constraints. But a big new idea in the sciences is self-organization. Now, I think that's a terrible term for it. There's no self, and it's not bringing it to some fixed state of organization. But what I will call emergent regularization is another name for self-organization. And a good example of it is simply this. Imagine yourself threading your way through a congested crowd. And in your threading, others are threading around you. As a result, you'll end up with congestion here and there. And that's a kind of a process of path elimination that leads the flows down paths of least resistance.
Okay.
That's the core explanation for what's going on in self-organization, which is the generation of whirlpools, the generation of crystals, chemical chain reactions. All of those are examples of emergent constraint. It's not an imposed constraint like the riverbank or the engine cylinder. No, it's a constraint that emerges throughout dynamic interaction. Now, us threading through a crowd, we have values, we're trying to get places. But the same approach applies to the explanation of, for example, whirlpools. So water molecules are not trying to get anywhere, they're not striving for anything, and yet the turbulence will simplify into paths of least resistance by a process of path elimination. You end up with a whirlpool because it's a path of least resistance. How is it produced? It's because of the emergent congestion as turbulence interacts with each other. Now, some people think of self-organization or emergent regularization as enough to explain life. We don't, because, for example, a whirlpool at the drain in your tub drains the water out faster. The self-organization you see in a crowd thins the crowd and eliminates the crowd. Yeah. So it is actually self-degenerative. It's not going against the flow except locally and temporarily. So we have to explain, since that's not going to be enough, how would you ever get it generates regularities. That is, people all moving, threading through in lines, or water flowing in a spiral flow. That's a regularity. That is, things moving in the same direction. But it is not the same. A regularity is not all we do. So we have a theory for how you go from self-organization to organisms. But it does still employ this core concept, which is something different from nothing but chemistry. It's the way that the chemistry constrains itself,
okay,
through a process of emergent constraint.
Okay, so you've got emergent regularization, and then there's another type of emergent constraint which you called self-regeneration, but that's a sort of higher form of emergent constraint where two dynamic processes are in interplay.
That's right. Nicely put. So our bodies are full of regularities. This is something that's often overlooked in another possible explanation for what we are. We are just more complex. Living beings are just more complex cause and effect phenomena. At some point, you cross a threshold, and now you're alive. So if you get enough computers together, because they're just machines, but if you get enough of them together, you'll get a living being. We don't buy that argument. And one of the reasons why is that complexity can mean either two things. One is harder to describe, and the other is harder to explain. So which is more complex? I have a frog on the cover of my book. One of the reasons it's on there is because in the book I pose this question, which is more complex, a frog or a frog smoothie? If you ground up a frog, it is actually more complex. That is, there's no correlation between the molecules in a frog smoothie. So to describe the overall configuration of it, it would be much more complex. A frog is full of regularities, skin cells next to skin cells, bone cells next to bone cells. So that's harder to explain. And yet it's actually less complex. Why? Because there are more regularities. So we have to explain the regularities in our bodies, but not just the same way. It won't work to say, well, we're just like whirlpools, which are regularized. So our solution to that is, if you get two self-organizing or emergent regularization processes that are constraints on each other, such that they don't peter out, that they don't fall apart, that they keep each other going, that would be the first thing that is preventing its own ending. And we will argue that as primitive and counterintuitive looking as it is, that would be the first striving. So the first striving isn't going to look like us. It's not going to, it has no feelings. It has no consciousness. We start at the most basic level, unlike all the people in cognitive science who think that you can go straight from physics to consciousness. No, we're interested in striving from patient zero, the very first case of striving, which is bound to be very primitive, but it's still going to have to go against the flow of the second law. And we think you get this through a combination of two processes that each constrain each other such that they don't degenerate.
Okay, and how do they do that?
Well, so I mentioned in passing that there are two kinds of self-organization, recognized as self-organization. One is chemical chain reactions called autocatalysis or reciprocal catalysis. That's where you get basically a population explosion of molecules. They're not trying to do anything. They're not striving. But the molecules interact in such a way that they produce more molecules like each other. Okay. So a simple example, if you've got a catalyst A that turns reactants into catalyst B, and catalyst B that turns reactants into catalyst A, you end up with a population, a growing population of catalysts A and B, and an increased constraint on reactants. You can think of it like an epidemic in a town. The more people have the illness, the less likely you will be to not gain the contagion through exposure. So that's what's going on with the reactants. They are constrained more and more to becoming catalysts A and B. Yeah. But you can think of all this as just a chemical chain reaction. So the chemical chain reaction grows. It converts the reactants, but the reactants so the reactants go away. At some point, the catalysts are all you've got a large population of catalysts, but it will peter out.
Yeah.
That is, it will run out of reactants and it will dissipate. So that's one. So you got the chemical chain reaction, and it tends to end. The other one is crystal formation. It's going the other direction energetically. That is, it gives off energy. But crystal formation is basically the more molecules that you have that are aligned with each other, that basically fall into alignment with each other, the larger the surface on which more molecules might accumulate.
Okay.
So the larger, there again, you see this tendency for crystal formation to grow for a while, and crystals take all sorts of form, from rocks to bubbles, which aren't actually called crystals, and yet it's still an alignment process with lipids. You get sheets, you get shells, and one that we focus on is the capsid shell. Capsid molecules are molecules that happen to align to form shells or tubes. They're employed by viruses.
Right.
But nothing assembles them into formation. You pour a bunch of capsid molecules into a solution, they will fall together into these shells. But the shells are likely to break over time, and as they do, they will lose parts of them. And so they will tend to end too. So what Terry Deacon, the founder of this approach, is arguing is that if you get a chemical chain reaction that happens to have a byproduct that is a capsid molecule, it's a side product.
Yeah.
The capsid molecules will tend to form shells in the midst of the chain reaction that will capture a sufficient quantity of the catalysts such that it forms a kind of chain reaction seed. So if that chain reaction seed happens to break open in the presence of more reactants, more raw materials for the chain reaction, it will resume autocatalysis, the chemical chain reaction, and the production of the seeds. And hence, you've got something that is working against the tendency to peter out and fall apart.
Wow.
In that the two processes are means to preventing each other from ending.
Okay, so let me see if I can just paraphrase that just to say I've got the concept.
Please, go ahead.
Yeah, so The capsid is the is a sphere,
a shell,
as a seed, and within it it will contain the catalysts, and then something happens where it gets banged into by another larger molecule. So then it breaks, the catalysts break out, and if there are reactants around, then there's a reaction with those, and the byproducts are the caspid parts, and then not only will then potentially that capsid sphere reform with catalyst in it, but then potentially new ones will form as well. So then you've basically got another capsid with other catalysts in it.
Beautifully put. So we boiled down what it takes to strive, what it takes to go against the flow, as three processes and a fourth that's kind of a necessary condition for the other three. So the first is self-repair. That is, things are going to fall apart, so you're going to have to repair them as you go.
Yeah.
And just for the record, while we think of ourselves as conscious and emotional, right now you and I are doing all sorts of unconscious stuff to repair ourselves. That is, we're regenerating cells even while we're having this conversation, and I have no idea how it's happening. I don't need to know. And anyway, there I am self-repairing. So there's something about me that is still a kind of vegetative striving, even though I think of myself as a thinking, feeling being. So there's self-repair. That's one thing you'd need. If you're going to prevent yourself from totally degenerating, you're going to have to repair what degenerates. You're also going to have to protect against degeneration. So I have a roof over my head and clothes on my body, and I have skin, and I have all this sort of stuff. I have an immune system. I'm doing all sorts of things to prevent degenerative things from happening to me. And then, since I will lose in the end, that is, I myself will die, I do have to somehow pass on this capacity for self-repair and self-protection to offspring. I have three. So you've got self-repair, self-protection, and self-reproduction. Now, just notice this, that in most biology, we talk about it as self-replication, and the assumption being that if you get a molecule that replicates, then you're all the way on the way to life. No, a molecule is doing none of this self-repair or self-protection. It's not in that business at all. And it's not just self-replication of a pattern. A pattern can pass on, but there be no striving involved in it. You know, wind currents lead to other wind currents, all of that. But that's not striving. So you've got these three things: self-repair, self-protection, and self-reproduction. And notice this complication that results from it. I call it selective interaction. If you're going to self-repair and you're going to self-reproduce, you're going to have to be taking in energy and resources. No man is an island, but you can say we are all islands, and yet we have to import and export, or else we won't stay islands. At the same time, self-protection is about keeping out stuff. So a core dilemma, one of the middle way issues that life has to deal with from the beginning, is what to take in and what not to take in, what to put out and what not to. And here's a core challenge in chemistry. We do that currently through all sorts of orifices and pores, which are highly evolved to let in the right stuff and not the wrong stuff. I would also argue, I've written over 800 articles for Psychology Today under the name Ambigamy, Insights for the Deeply Romantic and Deeply Skeptical. These are articles dealing with the middle way challenges of wanting to join with things, the romantic urge. I'm not just talking sexually here. I'm just saying romantically, we want to embrace stuff. At the same time, we don't want to embrace the wrong things. I want to keep an open mind, but I don't want my brains to spill out. That's going on from the origins of life.
Yeah.
And that's the selective interaction thing. And the chances that you would get some selective membrane, the equivalent of our skin with pores and orifices, at the origins from strictly chemistry, impossible. You're not going to get some perfect closed membrane that lets in and out the right stuff and doesn't let in and out the wrong stuff. And so that becomes one of the core challenges in this work. How are you ever going to get selective interaction if the only way that could happen is through evolution? And evolution is, their only selves evolve. Evolution doesn't start, selves. It's not like evolution is this new force imposed on the world halfway through the universe's history that creates life. No, life has to be striving, because only striving evolves. So in our model, we have a solution to that selective interaction one. But notice what you get with the thing I've described, this coupling of the crystal formation and the chain reaction, the chemical chain reaction. You get self-repair. When a seed breaks, it spontaneously starts regenerating seeds. It repairs the seed because you get a new chemical chain reaction if it breaks in the presence of reactants. And it will, and as you say, it will. There are different combinations. You get different variety in what's produced each time it goes. It repairs. You get self-protection in the form of the capsid molecule, the capsid shell, which is completely sealed. You get self-reproduction, as you were indicating a minute ago. That is, if it breaks open, you're producing a bunch of these capsid molecule byproducts, and they can form multiple varied seeds as a result. And where is the selective interaction in this? It's in the alternation between being completely closed and being completely open. And this points to where the self actually is. It's not a material thing. It's not the energy that comes in. It's in the tendency for closed seeds to break open and the tendency of open processes to close.
Okay.
It's actually in the constraint. It's in the prevention. What's presented, what's interesting to us, is a product of what's prevented.
Sure. That's really cool. So you call this first model the minimal autogen, but that,
yes,
that has a problem in the sense that it could open when there are no reactants around, or it could stay closed when there are plenty of reactants around. But you also have a proposal for what you call a selective autogen. Could you just unpack that one a bit?
Yes, perfect. Thank you for bringing that up. So when I said that the autogen, this model we have where you got the chain reaction that is producing capsid molecule byproducts that close and form these seeds. So it's basically a chain reaction that generates chain reaction seeds. When I said that it was selectively interactive, that's not true. It's not really selective at this point. It's doing nothing to choose when it's open, when the seeds are open. The seeds are open when it happens to break. And that is a problem. But you also still get the core, you could say, repertoire. That is, the middle ways of our lives from the very beginning include having a repertoire of different moves you can make.
Yeah.
And the quest for the wisdom to know the difference between when to use which move and when to use that, I argue, is there from the beginning of life. But the minimal autogen does not do any of that selection. But imagine this. As you said earlier, you've got, when you get the chemical chain reaction, there can be other interactions. It's not a specified robotic mechanistic process by which the chain reaction generates the seeds. The seeds will vary, and they won't just vary in the quantity of catalysts that they have inside, but also the variety of catalysts. That is, you can sometimes get a substitute catalyst that generates a different kind of capsid molecule, which generates a different kind of capsid shell. So you get variety, and we would say that given the striving, this minimal striving we see in the minimal autogen, you get evolution. That is, that some varieties will do better than others, not because natural selection is selecting them. Natural selection is basically the failure of striving selves to continue. So what you'd get, though, is imagine you get a variation that has a capsid shell that tends to bind with reactants. That is, if a reactant touches it, it's going to bind with it, and you end up with this rougher surface because it's got the reactant sticking to it. Now, this is just a thought experiment. We haven't actually demonstrated it in bench science yet. But you end up with a rougher surface when it's in the presence of reactants, which makes it more likely to break open. So in this, you really would have a selective capacity. It's basically as though it had if there are reactants present, open. If it doesn't have reactants present, close. in this, you actually do get a primitive version of the serenity prayer. That is, grant me the serenity to stay close when there's nothing I can change, nothing I can transform into facilitation of my striving, and the courage to break open in the presence of reactants that I can change into more of me. Obviously, none of this is conscious, none of this is felt, but I do find it vivid that life has been dealing with these middle way challenges from the beginning, and the threat of a false positive and a false negative, that is what you don't want, is the serenity accept what in fact you could transform, which we would, as you described it a minute ago, staying closed when there are reactants you can transform is basically the equivalent of the serenity to accept what in fact you could change into for benefit.
Yeah.
And the other, which would be the courage to try to change what in fact you couldn't change,
yeah,
which is breaking open in the presence of an environment where there's nothing you can transform into yourself.
Sure.
I find that all the way at the very beginning of value. These things are not trying to, they're not thinking, they're not feeling, but then again, most life isn't. We're the rare exception, and we don't want to start from us. We want to start from the very beginning.
Right, beginning. Okay, so one of your latter chapters is how we make science safe for value. Could you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, actually, in the last few weeks, I'm bold enough to say how to make science honest about value. I mostly work in the social sciences, and in the social sciences, it's perfectly fine. It's truly fine to start from the assumption that we have motivations and values, and then to work out the details of how they manifest. So an appetite for something yields these kinds of behaviors. One of the things about interpretation as compared to cause and effect is it's much less determinate. That is, if I'm interpreting a stop sign as reason to stop, I can stop a variety of different ways, and it can have a variety of different consequences. So interpretation and values are, it's fine to isolate a part of an area of research where you start with certain assumptions and then work out the consequences of them. In that respect, the sciences are honest about values, but you cannot do that when you're trying to explain, when you're trying to close this gap between matter and mattering. You can't assume value if you're trying to explain value. So in that realm, science remains dishonest, I would say. It's not just making science safer, it's also making it honest. A classic example, you read any of the great, wonderful books written by the big name scientists, the Dan Dennett's or Robert Sapolsky's, what they'll do is they'll just gloss right over it. They say, this molecule yields you this motivation. Well, how? It's a molecule. Molecules don't have motivations. You can't just gloss over that like this. You have to explain it. And the explanations tend to be equivocations like that, where you're talking out both sides of your mouth. On the one hand, you're saying it's all cause and effect chemistry, and on the other, it's means to ends striving. How do you explain that difference?
The autogen, you say, is obvious, is a thought experiment, but unlike other thought experiments, it can be in empirically tested. Has that process started yet?
It has. The way that it would these days, in it being done in computer emulation. So this is, I just did a Google talk a couple of weeks ago, and I make a distinction between simulation and emulation. So what we've got currently is a model for the autogen that is being generated by a guy who read the book, liked it a lot. He was one of the 30 under 30 in video game development for Forbes magazine. So he's a big name these days in that work. He developed the Sony virtual reality set. And he just said, I want to design a model for this. So that's how in chemistry these days, a lot of chemistry is now being done in virtual chemistry first. That is, you work out the parameters so that you can begin to look for what molecules you're after by working out the details in an emulation. Now, let me just say something briefly about the difference between simulation and emulation. There are all sorts of computer models This is about the, this is on the question of Cartesian apartheid. That is, you can come up with software that yields consequences like a living being's consequences. So that's what AI is. You come up with a computer that generates something like the learning we see as a consequence of living beings. The mistake with this, which I'll call simulation, is that it doesn't tell you anything about how the living being yields those consequences. As I can make a model of something that has no bearing on how the thing I'm modeling actually does it. So we have been meticulous in our emulation to start with everything possible and figure out how the constraints emerge in the process as we are trying to model a system that would act like an autogen, even though it's in a computer model. Once we have that thing working and have fine-tuned it, we will know what are the candidate molecules from which you could begin to do the lab science, the bench science.
Great. Okay. And the book's been out approximately about 9 months, a year or something like that?
A year this month.
Okay. And I imagine there's been some critical feedback of the book. Has there been a pattern there, and to what degree have you found that useful?
So far, the criticism has been generic. It's the same stuff I expected. In fact, it's the same stuff I encouraged. I hired Oxford's former head of promotion for its trade books to do promotion for my book, and his counsel was, go out there and poke some eyes. He said, if you want to get some attention for this thing, you're going to have to actually speak boldly about this. And this was an interesting challenge because Terence Deacon, the founder of this stuff, he is not an eye poker. His theories poke everyone's eyes. And yet he's, by temperament, he's a gentleman. He's got a little bit of the Darwin about him in this respect. I'm not drawing parallels, but I'm just saying he's a gentle soul. I'm an eye poker. I'm happy to poke eyes. The responses I get fit into the yes, it's a ghost or yes, it's a machine variation. One of my most successful eye pokes was to win the vituperation of Jerry Coyne. Jerry Coyne is a very competent biologist who has branched into biology and is now one of these new atheists. He yearns to be one of the four horsemen of the atheist movement. He's kind of an also-ran, unfortunately. In part, he's so strident. So, but every morning he wakes up and he looks for something to attack. And twice now he has attacked my muddle-headedness for not recognizing that it is all cause and effect from top to bottom. You may strive to believe that you strive, but you don't. It's basically the pretzel logic being employed by these people. They say, you're right, you may interpret yourself as interpreting, but you don't interpret. It just doesn't make any sense, but it's part of this desperate, what I would call an overstep in the right direction that we've been living with since the Enlightenment. That is, we realize it's not all God's purposes, and then we went too far. We assumed, therefore, it's all cause and effect. And now we're beginning to move back to recognize, no, we still have to explain value. It's not, that stuff is not reducible to cause and effect chemistry. But you will get these guys who are, they are hyper-romantic anti-romanticists. They engage in what I call dreadful thinking. So wishful thinking is, it must be true because I want it to be. And dreadful thinking is, it must be true because you don't want it to be. So they're basically romanticizing themselves. They are prophets of the new crusade, saying sooner or later they are going to convince everybody to strive for not striving because striving doesn't exist. So I've gotten a little bit of that, and I've also gotten from feedback from people, for example, who say, well, the laws of I got one the other day from someone who said a natural law, physical law, so they're enforced by God. And therefore, that's how it all comes about. So you get people who want to fall off on either side of the ghost machine dichotomy, and we're trying to walk this tightrope and saying, no, we cannot pretend we know the source of it just because we have a name for it, or we cannot imagine a source for striving, nor can we deny the existence of striving. We have to walk this tightrope and not fall over in either direction.
You've talked quite a bit about at times in our chat today about the middle way. I'd just be quite interested, Jeremy. What does it mean to you? What if you know, if you could provide a definition of the middle way from your perspective, what is that, and how might it relate to what we've been talking about today?
I guess it would be a wonderful conversation I'd love to have with you sometime, because I've spent a lot of time on the middle way. That's mostly where my work in the life and social sciences are. But the way I would describe it is that moral dilemmas are way more fundamental than moral principles. That if you don't see the benefits and costs to all your options, you're going to have a heck of a time finding the right option for the situation.
Okay.
So that's kind of core to it. Yeah, it's how to shop for the best interpretation in the situation. And just this illustration, the middle way is for me a stance. I can think of it like playing tennis. You want to keep on coming back to the tough judgment calls in the middle. That is, you want to keep on recentering yourself, but that doesn't mean you stay in the center. You have to be able to get to either side of the court or anywhere on the court, but you need to maintain a position of so the middle way for me is doubt. It's actually to be able to wonder what to do rather than take a stance.
Yeah.
So there are people naturally who will take the middle way as a stance. But that gets you into the kind of problem I was talking about,
exactly,
where you just simply split the difference.
Yeah, yeah.
The way I frame that up as a moral development, I call it hard left, hard right, hard center, hard choices. So hard left is love is the answer, and then hard right is ouch, that didn't work. Toughness is the answer. And then ouch, that didn't work. Tough love is the answer. That's hard center. So hard left, hard right, hard center. Tough love is the answer. And then hard choices is, oh no, tough love is the question. When to be tough, when to be loving.
That's brilliant. Now, I fully endorse that, Jeremy. For me, at the core of the middle way is the recognition of uncertainty. So even the middle way,
yes,
itself is something that is provisional. And that's what
I
really like about the middle way society, that we all see that it is a work in progress and something that is that we're all involved in. We don't believe in final goals. We're interested in the process.
That makes good sense. I think we have that in common here, is the interest in the tough judgment calls. And here's the core of it for me. So I am a fallibilist. There's a term coined by Charles Sanders Peirce, the founder of pragmatism and semiotics, which is basically the exploration, the science of interpretation. But a fallibilist, I would define a fallibilist as, no matter how confident I am in a bet, I am still more confident that it is a bet.
Yeah, that's great.
I think the great culture wars of our day and of all times have been the battles between fallibilists and infallibilists. Because an infallibilist believes, and I understand the impulse, that they have nailed it, that they have the moral principle, and even more specious, that they are living by it.
Yeah.
And we are dealing with a serious epidemic of infallibilism right now in the United States, under the influence of Donald Trump. So the current book I'm working on is actually an exposure of this issue. It's called Troll Model, Trump Takeaways for the Hard Art of Identifying and Thwarting Jerks. I consider myself a psychoproctologist. I've spent 20 years on this question. It's basically a constraint-based approach, which is, in a free society, you don't get to tell people what to do, but you still have to put a leash on the jerks, or it won't remain a free society. So how do you identify a jerk? What is a butthead, since it can't just be anybody I'd butt heads with? And I've decided, I come to the conclusion that it's infallibilism. It's the claim that it's not dilemmas we're dealing with, that we have somehow transcended life's 3.8 billion year legacy of guesswork. All organisms are guessing what will work. And that somehow we have come to the point where we can claim triumph and say, we now know exactly what works. Boy, I know that impulse. It's a product of how complicated human life is with the capacity for language. But it has to be combated. it actually has to be moved to the realm of fantasy. That is, I have the impulse towards infallibility, and I exercise it by watching movies in which the hero does always the right thing, and I get to identify with them. But I don't bring that into everyday life. That would be nonsense. That is, do it offline. You know, indulge your infallibilist fantasies out offline, and in reality, face the fact that you're guessing what will work.
Okay, well, that's very interesting. Right. Well, and that brings me to my last question, Jeremy. If people wanted to find out more about your work, how would they go about it?
Well, they can look up the term ambigamy on spelled as it sounds, A-M-B-I-G-A-M-Y. Possibly, it's an eye-poking term, I suppose, but it's where I happen to have most of my articles. This is a Psychology Today blog. They can contact me. I'm at js@jeremysherman.com. I'm available for conversation or questions or challenges or critiques. Those are probably the two best ways to find me at present. Also, check out my book. Also, check me out on YouTube. I have two sites. One is called Neither Ghost Nor Machine, where I explain this origins of life story and its implications for things like free will in short videos. And I have another one called Butthead Theory, which is where I play out my psychoproctology work. It's where I do this attempt at a careful analysis of what makes for out-of-bounds behavior. It's basically a constraint-based approach to moral questions. That you can do anything you want. Apparently, the world is full of a lot of diverse ways to live, and they many of them work. So don't tell people what to do, which is the tendency, the tradition in moral philosophy. Don't seek the infallible moral principle. Figure out what the out-of-bounds behavior is and try and constrain yourself and others to that. That's the work that you'll find on my YouTube video series, Butthead Theory.
Very interesting. Well, thank you so much for talking to me today, Jeremy. It's been absolutely fascinating, and I'm so intrigued by this idea. You know, I mean, it could potentially be paradigm shifting, I think.
Yes, I like that. I hope for that, and I know what we're up against. There are a lot of reasons why it's a hard move, especially these days. The computational model of what life is going great guns because it is so productive industrially. But philosophically, it's going to hit a wall. That is, we are not machines, and machines are not us, and no quantity of adding more cause and effect stuff will generate a machine. It's not a matter of adding more complexity. So I think that one way or another, these ideas will have their day. Possibly not in my lifetime, but it's great striving to give them some legs.
Yeah, well, you might have just started the ball rolling.
Exactly. All right.
You can find out more about Middleway philosophy at www.middlewaysociety.org.